Welcome to Coco Club.
Coco Club is a radio program put on by the Hotchkiss Library of Sharon and Robin Hood Radio. Tune in to WHDD 91.9 each week and join me, Mrs. Sam, for a short story, a poem, some cocoa, and a sweet dessert. This is a weekly series. The recipe for each dessert will be posted the week previous, so we can all try our hand in baking something new and enjoy it as a family while we listen to a story. I'll ask questions at the end of Coco Club to help every listener engage with each other about the story's meaning and what they liked about it. Please join us on social media to post photos of how your recipe turned out or tell us what you thought about the story at facebook.com/Hotchkiss Library. This week we are finishing the wonderful story of Henry Sugar by Roald Dahl. This is the fourth part in the four parts that I've read it. You can find the first three parts on Robin Hood Radio's website. Roald Dahl was a British novelist, short story writer, poet, screenwriter, and wartime fighter pilot. So here is part four of the wonderful story of Henry Sugar by Roald Dahl. After walking the London streets for about an hour, Henry returned to the Lord's house and collected his car. Then he drove back to his flat. He was a puzzled man. He couldn't understand why he felt so little excitement about his tremendous success. If this sort of thing happened to him 3 years ago, before he'd started the yoga business, he'd have gone crazy with excitement. He'd have been dancing in the streets and rushing off to the nearest nightclub to celebrate with champagne. The funny thing was that he didn't really feel excited at all. He felt melancholy. It somehow had all been too easy. Every time he'd made a bet, he'd been certain of winning. There was no thrill, no suspense, no danger of losing. He knew, of course, that from now on he could travel around the world and make millions. But was it going to be any fun doing it? It was slowly beginning to dawn upon Henry that nothing is any fun if you can't get as much of it as you want. Let's read that again, shall we? Because that's a really good line. It was slowly beginning to dawn upon Henry that nothing is any fun if you can get as much of it as you want, especially money. Another thing, was it not possible that the process he had gone through in order to acquire yoga powers had completely changed his outlook on life? Certainly it was possible. Henry drove home and went straight to bed. The next morning he woke up late, but he didn't feel any more cheerful now than he had the night before. And when he got out of bed and saw the enormous bundle of money still lying on his dressing table, he felt a sudden and very acute revulsion toward it. He didn't want it. For the life of him, he couldn't explain why this was so, but the fact remained that he simply did not want any part of it. He picked up the bundle. It was all in 20-pound notes, 330 of them to be exact. He walked onto the balcony of his flat, and there he stood, in his dark red silk pajamas, looking down at the street below him. Henry's flat was on Curzon Street, which is right in the middle of London's most fashionable and expensive district, known as Mayfair. One end of Curzon Street runs into Berkeley Square, and the other into Park Lane. Henry lived three floors above street level, and outside his bedroom there was a small balcony with iron railings that overhung the street. The month was June. The morning was full of sunshine, and the time was about 11 o'clock. Although it was a Sunday, there were quite a few people strolling about on the sidewalks. Henry peeled off a single 20-pound note from his wad and dropped it over the balcony. A breeze took hold of it and blew it sideways in the direction of Park Lane. Henry stood watching it. It fluttered and twisted in the air and eventually came to rest on the opposite side of the street, directly in front of an old man. The old man was wearing a long, brown, shabby coat and a floppy hat, and he was walking slowly, all by himself. He caught sight of the note as it fluttered past his face, and he stopped and picked it up. He held it with both hands and stared at it. He turned it over. He peered closer. Then he raised his head and looked up. "Hey there!" Henry shouted, cupping a hand to his mouth. "That's for you! It's a present!" The old man stood quite still, holding the note in front of him and gazing up at the figure on the balcony above. "Put it in your pocket," Henry shouted. "Take it home." His voice carried far along the street, and many people stopped and looked up. Henry peeled off another note and threw it down. The watchers below him didn't move. They simply watched. They had no idea what was going on. A man was up there on the balcony, and he had shouted something. Now he had just thrown down what looked like a piece of paper. Everyone followed the piece of paper as it went fluttering down, and this one came near to a young couple who were standing arm in arm on the sidewalk across the street. The man unlinked his arm and tried to catch the paper as it went past him. He missed it, but picked it up from the ground. He examined it closely. The watchers on both sides of the street all had their eyes on the young man now. Too many of them. The paper had looked very much like a banknote of some kind, and they were waiting to find out. "It's £20," the man yelled, jumping up and down. "It's a £20 note." "Keep it," Henry shouted at him. "It's yours." "You mean it?" the man called back, holding the note out at arm's length. "Can I really keep it?" Suddenly, there was a rustle of excitement along both sides of the street, and everyone started moving at once. They ran out into the middle of the road and clustered underneath the balcony. They lifted their arms above their heads and started calling out, "Me! How about one for me? Drop us another one! Send down a few more!" Henry peeled off another 5 or 6 notes and threw them down. There were screams and yells as the pieces of paper fanned out in the wind and floated downward, and there was a good old-fashioned scrimmage in the streets as they reached the hands of the crowd. But it was all very good-natured. People were laughing. They thought it was a fantastic joke. Here was a man standing 3 floors up, in his pajamas, slinging these enormously valuable notes into the air. Quite a few of those present had never even seen a £20 note in their lives before this moment. But now something else was beginning to happen. The speed with which news will spread along the streets of a city is phenomenal. The news of what Henry was doing flashed like lightning up and down the length of Curzon Street and into the smaller and larger streets beyond. From all sides, people came running. Within a few minutes, about 1,000 men and women and children were blocking up the road underneath Henry's balcony. Drivers who couldn't get through got out of their cars and joined the crowd. And all of a sudden, there was chaos in Curzon Street. At this point, Henry simply raised his arm and swung it out and flung the entire bundle of notes into the air. More than 6,000 pounds went fluttering down toward the screaming crowd below. The scramble that followed was really something to see. People were jumping up to catch the notes before they reached the ground, and everyone was pushing and jostling and yelling and falling over, and soon the whole place was a mass of tangled, yelling, fighting human beings. Above the noise, and behind him in his own flat, Henry suddenly heard his front door bell ringing long and loud. He went from the balcony and opened the door. A large policeman with a black mustache stood outside with his hands on his hips. "You," he bellowed angrily. "You're the one. What the devil do you think you're doing?" "Good morning, officer," Henry said. "I'm sorry about the crowd. I didn't think it would turn out like that. I was just giving away some money." "You're causing a nuisance," the policeman bellowed. "You're creating an obstruction. You're inciting a riot and you're blocking the entire street." "I said I was sorry," Henry answered. "I won't do it again, I promise. They'll soon go away." The policeman took one hand off his hip and from the inside of his palm he produced a £20 note. "Aha," Henry cried, "you've got one yourself. I'm so glad. I'm so happy for you." "Now you just stop lurking about," the policeman said, "because I have a few serious questions to ask you about these here £20 notes." He took a notebook from his breast pocket. "In the first place," he said, "where exactly did you get them from?" "I won them," Henry said. "I had a lucky night." He went on to give the name of the club where he had won the money, and the policeman wrote it down in his little book. "Check it up," Henry added. "They'll tell you it's true." The policeman lowered the notebook and looked at Henry in the eye. "As a matter of fact," he said, "I believe your story. I think you're telling the truth. But that doesn't excuse what you did one little bit." "I didn't do anything wrong," Henry said. "You're a blithering young idiot," the policeman shouted, beginning to work himself up all over again. "You're an ass and an imbecile. If you're lucky enough to win yourself a tremendous big sum of money like that, and you want to give it away, you don't go throw it out of the window." "Why not?" Henry asked, grinning. "It's as good as anywhere getting rid of money. "It's a damned stupid, silly way of getting rid of it," the policeman cried. "Why didn't you give it where it would be, where it would do some good? To a hospital, for instance, or an orphanage. There's orphanages all over the country that hardly have enough money to buy kids a present, even for Christmas. And then along comes a little twit like you, who's never even known what it's like to be hard up, and you throw the stuff out into the street. It makes me mad, it really does."
"An orphanage?" Henry said.
"Yes, an orphanage," the policeman cried. "I was brought up in one, so I ought to know what it's like." And with that, the policeman turned away and went quickly down the stairs toward the street. Henry didn't move. The policeman's words, and more especially the genuine fury with which they had been spoken, smacked our hero right between the eyes. "An orphanage?" he cried aloud. "That's quite a thought. But why only one orphanage? Why not lots of them?" And now, very quickly, there began to come to him the great and marvelous idea that was to change everything. Henry shut the front door and went back into his flat. All at once he felt a powerful excitement stirring in his belly. He started pacing up and down, ticking off the points that would make his marvelous idea possible. "One," he said, "I can get hold of a very large sum of money each day of my life. Two, I must not go to the same casino more than once for every 12 months. Three, I must not win too much money from any one casino, or somebody will get suspicious. I suggest I keep it down to £20,000 a night. Four, £20,000 a night for 365 days in the year comes to how much?" Henry took a pencil and paper and worked this one out. "Comes to £7,300,000, he said aloud. "Very well. Point number five. I shall have to keep moving. No more than 2 or 3 nights at a stretch in any one city, or the word will get around. Go from London to Monte Carlo, then to the Canes, to Belize, to Deauville, to Las Vegas, to Mexico City, to Buenos Aires, to Nassau, and so on. Six. With the money I make, I will set up an absolutely first-class orphanage in every country I visit. I will become a Robin Hood. I'll take money from the bookmakers and the gambling proprietors, and I'll give it to the children. Does that sound corny and sentimental? As a dream, it does. But as a reality, if I can really make it work, it wouldn't be corny at all, or sentimental. It'd be rather tremendous. Seven. I need somebody to help me. A man who will sit at home and take care of all that money, and buy the houses and organize the whole thing. A money man. Someone I can trust. What about John Winston?" John Winston was Henry's accountant. He handled his income tax affairs, his investments, and all other problems that had to do with money. Henry had known him for 18 years, and a friendship had developed between the two men. Remember, though, that up till now, John Winston had only known Henry as the wealthy, idle playboy who'd never done a day's work in his life. "You must be mad," John Winston said when Henry told him his plan. "Nobody has ever devised a system for beating the casinos." From his pocket, Henry produced a brand new, unopened pack of cards. "Come on," he said. "We'll play a little blackjack. You're the dealer. And don't tell me those cards are marked. It's a new pack." Solemnly, for nearly an hour, sitting in Winston's office, whose windows looked out over Berkeley Square, the two men played blackjack. They used matchsticks as counters, each match being worth £25. After 50 minutes, Henry was no less than £34,000 ahead. John Winston couldn't believe it. "How do you do it?" he said. "Put the pack on the table," Henry said, face down. Winston obeyed. Henry concentrated on the top of the card for 4 seconds. "That's a knave of hearts," he said. It was. "The next one is a three of hearts." It was. He went right down the entire pack, naming every card. "Go on," John Winston said. "Tell me how you do it." This usually calm and mathematical man was leaning forward over his desk, staring at Henry with eyes as big and bright as 2 stars. "Do you realize you are doing something completely impossible?" he said. "It's not impossible," Henry said. "It's only very difficult. I am the one man in the world who can do it." The telephone rang on John Winston's desk. He lifted the receiver and said to his secretary, "No more calls, please, Susan, until I tell you, not even my wife." He looked up, waiting for Henry to go on. Henry then proceeded to explain to John Winston exactly how he had acquired the power. He told him how he had found the notebook about Imrat Khan, and then he described how he had been working nonstop for the past 3 years, training his mind to concentrate. When he had finished, John Winston said, "Have you tried walking on fire?" "No," Henry said, "and I'm not going to." "What makes you think you'll be able to do this thing with the cards in a casino?" Henry then told him about his visit to the Lord's house the night before. £6,600, John Winston cried. "Did you honestly win that much in real money? "Listen," Henry said, I just won 34,000 from you in less than an hour." "So you did." "6,000 was the very least I could win," Henry said. "It was a terrific effort not to win more." "You will be the richest man on earth." "I don't want to be the richest man on earth," Henry said. "Not anymore." Then he told him about his plan for orphanages. When he finished, he said, "Will you join me, John? Will you be my money man, my banker, my administrator, and everything else? There'll be millions coming in every year." John Winston, a cautious and prudent accountant, would not agree to anything at all on the spur of the moment. "I want to see you in action first," he said. So that night they went together to the Ritz Club on Curzon Street. "Can't go to Lord's house again now for some time," Henry said. On the first spin of the roulette wheel, Henry staked £100 on number 27. It came up. The second time, he put it on number 4. That came up too. A total of 7,200 profit. An Arab standing next to Henry said, "I have just lost £55,000. How do you do it?" "Luck," Henry said. "Just luck." They moved into the blackjack room, and there, in half an hour, Henry won a further £10,000. Then he stopped. Outside in the street, John Winston said, "I believe you now. I'll come with you." "We start tomorrow," Henry said. "Do you really intend to do this every single night?" "Yes," Henry said. "I shall move very fast from place to place, from country to country, and every day I shall send the profits back to you through the banks. Do you realize how much it will add up to in a year?" "Millions," Henry said cheerfully. "About $7 million a year." "In that case, I can't operate out of this country," John Winston said. "The taxmen will have it all." "Go anywhere you like," Henry said. "It makes no difference to me. I trust you completely." "I shall go to Switzerland," John Winston said, "but not tomorrow. I can't just pull up and fly away. I'm not an unattached bachelor like you with no responsibilities. I must talk to my wife and children. I must give notice to my partners in the firm. I must sell my house. I must find another house in Switzerland. I must take the kids out of school. Dear man, these things take time." Henry drew from his pocket the £17,500 he had just won and handed them to the other man. "Here's some petty cash to tide you over until you get settled," he said. "But do hurry up. I want to get cracking." Within a week, John Winston was in Louisiana with an office high up on the lovely hillside town above Lake Geneva. His family would follow him as soon as possible. And Henry went to work in the casinos. 1 year later, he had sent a little over £8 million to John Winston in Louisiana. The money was sent 5 days a week to a Swiss company called Orphanages S.A. Nobody except John Winston and Henry knew where the money came from or what was going to happen to it. As for the Swiss authorities, they never want to know where the money comes from. Henry sent the money through the banks. The Monday remittance was always the biggest because it included Henry's take for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday when the banks were closed. He moved with an astonishing speed, and often the only clue that John Winston had to his whereabouts was the address of the bank that had been sent money on that particular day. Monday, it would come from Las Vegas, from Freeport, from Grand Cayman, from San Juan, from London, from Biarritz. It came from anywhere and everywhere, as long as there is a big casino in the city. For 7 years, all went well. Nearly £50 million had arrived in Louisiana and been safely banked away. Already, John Winston had got 3 orphanages established, one in France, one in England, and one in the United States. 5 more were on the way. Then came a bit of trouble. There is a grapevine among casino owners, and although Henry was always extraordinarily careful not to take too much from any one place on any one night, the news was bound to spread in the end. They got wise to him one night in Las Vegas, when Henry rather imprudently took $100,000 from each of the 3 separate casinos that all happened to be owned by the same mob. What happened was this. The morning after, when Henry was in his hotel room, packing to leave for the airport, there was a knock on his door. A bellhop came in and whispered to Henry that two men were waiting for him in the lobby. Other men, the bellhop said, were guarding the rear exit. These were very hard men, the bellhop said, and he did not give much for Henry's chances of survival if he were to go downstairs at this moment. "Why did you come and tell me?" Henry asked him. "Why are you on my side?" "I'm not on anyone's side," the bellhop said. "But we all know you won a lot of money last night, and I figured you might give me a nice present for tipping you off." "Thanks," Henry said, "but how do I get away? I'll give you $1,000 if you can get me out of here." "That's easy," the bellhop said. "Take your own clothes off and put on my uniform. Then walk out through the lobby with your suitcase. But tie me up before you leave. I've gotta by lying here on your floor tied up hand and foot, so they won't think I've helped you. I'll say you had a gun and I couldn't do nothing." "Where's the cord to tie you up with?" Henry asked. "Right here in my pocket," said the bellhop, grinning. Henry put on the bellhop's gold and green uniform, which wasn't too bad a fit. Then he tied the man up good and proper with the cord and stuffed a handkerchief in his mouth. Finally, he pushed 10 $100 bills under the carpet for the bellhop to collect later. Down in the lobby, two short, thick, black-haired thugs were watching the people as they came out of the elevators, but they hardly glanced at the man in the green and gold bellhop's uniform, who came out carrying a suitcase, and who walked smartly across the lobby and out through the revolving doors that led into the street. At the airport, Henry changed his flight and took the next plane to Los Angeles. Things were not going to be quite so easy from now on, he told himself, but that bellhop had given him an idea. In Los Angeles, and in nearby Hollywood and Beverly Hills, where all the film people live, Henry sought out the very best makeup man in the business. This was Max Engelman. Henry called on him. He liked him immediately. "How much do you earn?" Henry asked him. "Oh, about $40,000 a year," Max told him. "I'll give you $100,000, Henry said, "if you will come with me and be my makeup artist." "What's the big idea?" Max asked him. "I'll tell you," Henry said, and he did. Max was only the second person Henry had told. John Winston was the first. And when Henry showed Max how he could read the cards, Max was flabbergasted. "Great heavens, man," he said, "you could make a fortune." "I already have," Henry told him. "I've made 10 fortunes, but I want to make 10 more." He told Max about the orphanages. With John Winston's help, he had already set up 7 of them in 7 different countries. Max was a small, dark-skinned man who had escaped from Vienna when the Nazis went in. He had never married. He had no ties. He became wildly enthusiastic. "It's crazy," he cried. "It's the craziest thing I've ever heard in my life. I'll join you, man. Let's go." From then on, Max Engelman traveled everywhere with Henry and carried with him, in a trunk, such an assortment of wigs, false beards, sideburns, mustaches, and makeup materials as you have never seen. He could turn his master into any one of 30 or 40 unrecognizable people, and the casino managers, who were all watching for Henry now, never once saw him again as Mr. Henry Sugar. As a matter of fact, only a year after the Las Vegas episode, Henry and Max actually went back to that dangerous city, and on a warm, starry night, Henry took a cool $80,000 from the first of the big casinos he had visited before. He went disguised as an elderly Brazilian diplomat, and they never knew what hit him. Now that Henry no longer appeared as himself in the casinos, there were, of course, a number of other details that had to be taken care of, such as false identity cards and passports. In Monte Carlo, for example, a visitor must always show his passport before being allowed to enter the casino. Henry visited Monte Carlo 11 more times with Max's assistance, every time with a different passport and in a different disguise. Max adored the work. He loved creating new characters for Henry. "I have an entirely fresh one for you today," he would announce. "Just wait till you see it. Today you'll be an Arab sheik from Kuwait." Do we have an Arab passport?" Henry would ask. "And Arab papers?" "We have everything," Max would answer. "John Winston has sent me a lovely passport in the name of His Royal Highness Sheikh Abu Bey." And so it went on. Over the years, Max and Henry became as brothers. They were crusading brothers, Two men who move swiftly through the skies, milking the casinos of the world and sending money straight back to John Winston in Switzerland, where the company known as Orphanages SA grew richer and richer. Henry died last year, at the age of 63, his work completed. He had been at it for just on 20 years. His personal reference book listed 371 major casinos in 21 different countries or islands. He had visited them all many times, and he had never lost. According to John Winston's accounts, he had made altogether £144 million. He left 21 well-established, well-run orphanages scattered about the world, one in each country he visited. All of these were administered and financed by John and his staff. But how do I, who am neither Max Engelman nor John Winston, happen to know all this? And how did I come to write the story in the first place? I will tell you. Soon after Henry's death, John Winston telephoned me from Switzerland. He introduced himself simply as the head of a company calling itself Orphanages SA and asked me if I would come out to Lucerne and see him with a view to writing a brief history of the organization. I don't know how he got a hold of my name. He probably had a list of writers and stuck a pin into it. He would pay me well, he said, and he added, a remarkable man has died recently. His name was Henry Sugar. I think people ought to know a bit about what he has done. In my ignorance, I asked whether the story was really interesting enough to merit being put on paper. All right, said the man who now controlled £144 million. Forget it, I'll ask someone else. There are plenty of writers around. That needled me. No, I said, wait. Could you at least tell me who this Henry Sugar was and what he did? I've never heard of him. In 5 minutes on the phone, John Winston told me something about Henry Sugar's secret career. It was a secret no longer. Henry was dead and would never gamble again. I listened, enthralled. I'll be on the next plane, I said. Thank you, John Winston said. I would appreciate that. In Lausanne, I met John Winston, now over 70, and also Max Engelman, who was about the same age. They were both still shattered by Henry's death, Max even more so than John Winston, for Max had been beside him constantly for over 13 years. I loved him, Max said, a shadow falling over his face. He was a great man. He never thought about himself. He never kept a penny of the money he won, except what he needed to travel and eat. Listen. Once we were in Biarritz, and he had just been to the bank and given them £500,000 to send home to John. It was lunchtime. We went to a place and had a simple lunch, an omelette and a bottle of wine, and when the bill came, Henry hadn't got anything to pay it with. I hadn't either. He was a lovely man. John Winston told me everything he knew. He showed me the original dark blue notebook written by Dr. John Cartwright in Bombay in 1934 about Imrat Khan, and I copied it out word for word. Henry always carried it with him, John Winston said. In the end, he knew the whole thing by heart. He showed me the account books of Orphanages S.A., with Henry's winnings recorded in them day by day over 20 years, and a truly staggering sight they were. When he had finished, I said to him, "There's a big gap in this story, Mr. Winston. You've told me almost nothing about Henry's travels and about his adventures in the casinos of the world." "That's Max's story," John Winston said. "Max knows all about that because he was with him, but he says he wants to have a shot at writing it himself. He's already started." "Then why not let Max write the whole thing?" I asked. "He doesn't want to," John Winston said. "He only wants to write about Henry and Max. It should be a fantastic story if he ever gets it finished. But he's old now, like me, and I doubt he'll manage it." "One last question," I said. "You keep calling him Henry Sugar, and yet you tell me that wasn't his name. Don't you want me to say who he really was when I do the story?" "No," John Winston said. "Max and I promised never to reveal it. Oh, it'll probably leak out sooner or later. After all, he was from a fairly well-known English family. But I'd appreciate it if you don't try to find out. Just call him plain Mr. Henry Sugar." And that is what I have done. The end. So that was part 4 of The Wonderful Sugar, The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar by Roald Dahl. I have 2 questions for you guys to think about when you're talking about this story. Also, again, on the Robin Hood Radio website, on demand, you can find the previous parts, so you can listen to them if you haven't been able to. But my two questions are this. So, do you believe that it was a real story? Do you think that someone could train in yoga and learn how to see without using their eyes? And the second thing is, what do you think changed about Henry over the story? Why did he change his mind and decide that he wanted to do something charitable instead of amass a fortune for himself? Thank you for joining me this week for Cocoa Club. Cocoa Club is hosted by the Hotchkiss Library of Sharon and Robin Hood Radio. The sounds heard in this recording are from freesound.org. I'm Mrs. Sam, and I hope you tune in again next week.